Escuelas Oficiales de Idiomas de la Región de Murcia. Pruebas específicas de certificación. Inglés. Nivel C2. Convocatoria septiembre 2021. Comprensión de textos orales.
Task 1.
Listen to an interview about the life and role of African-American sailor Dory Miller, and choose the 6 statements from the list that are true according to the listening. Write your final answers in the grid provided below, as shown in the example. You will hear the recording twice.
Now you have 2.5 minutes to read the task.
Congress has voted to strip the names of Confederate generals from several army bases. The president has vowed that won't happen. The issue might not even be resolved before Election Day. Meanwhile, the Navy is charting a whole new course. Jay Price of member station WUNC reports.
Henry Kissinger called supercarriers 100,000 tons of diplomacy. That power is reflected in the Navy's conventions for naming them, the USS John F. Kennedy, the Reagan, the Lincoln. But one supercarrier now on the drawing boards breaks sharply with tradition, the USS Doris Miller.
That is the first time that that ship of that class would be named after, one, an enlisted person and an African-American.
Regina Akers is a historian with the Naval History and Heritage Command. Doris Dory Miller was one of the first American heroes of World War II. During the attack on Pearl Harbor, as his ship was sinking and captain dying, Miller jumped behind a machine gun and shot at Japanese planes until his ammunition was gone. Then he began rescuing sailors from the fiery waters of the harbor. As a black sailor in 1941, he wasn't even supposed to fire a gun.
One of the ways in which the Navy discriminated against African Americans was that they limited them to certain types of jobs. So for African Americans, not all, but many were messmen or stewards. Dory Miller was a messman, which meant that he basically took care of an officer, laid out his clothes, shined his shoes, and served meals.
An official Navy commendation list of those whose actions during the attack stood out mentioned a black sailor, but it didn't bother to name Miller, a 22-year-old sharecropper's son from Waco, Texas. The black press, though, discovered and published Miller's name.
And so the African-American community just swells up with pride. But at the same time, they're mad at the Navy for not having formally shared what Dory Miller did.
Black leaders at the time were already pressuring President Franklin D. Roosevelt for more opportunities for African Americans in the booming war industry and in the military. Roosevelt barely averted a march on Washington at one point. Admiral Chester Nimitz, the commander of the Pacific Fleet, wanted to take the bold step of awarding Miller the Navy Cross, then the third highest honor for heroism. Again, Regina Acres.
So in Nimitz's mind, the award would be good for the Navy and contradict the institutional racism that the Navy was known for.
Roosevelt, eager to keep the nation united behind the war effort, agreed. Miller's heroism was all but ignored by white America, but in the black community,
Miller, just like the flip of a switch, becomes a celebrity. He becomes one of the first heroes, period, of the war, but certainly one of the first African-American heroes of the war. He was on recruitment posters. His image was everywhere.
And in Miller, suddenly the black newspapers had a weapon they'd been looking for.
He was a catalyst that gave them a lot of strength very early in the war. And they were determined to promote him publicly.
Baylor University history professor Michael Parrish is co-author of Doris Miller, Pearl Harbor, and the Birth of the Civil Rights Movement. He says that in war after war, African Americans had fought for their country, hoping their service would be rewarded with more rights, then had their hopes dashed, until Miller stepped behind that gun.
Things came together at Pearl Harbor for Doris Miller and for the Civil Rights Movement, probably to maximum effect. So World War II was really the turning point in that long struggle.
Even before he got the medal, the Navy began training black sailors for jobs like gunner's mate, radio man, radar operator. Later, it began commissioning black officers. Finally, in 1948, President Harry S. Truman ordered the military desegregated. All of that, Parrish says, can be traced to Dory Miller. The decision to name the new supercarrier for Miller was made by Thomas Modley, who was acting Secretary of the Navy until April.
I think it was probably long overdue.
Modley says it simply seemed like the right thing to do, given the U.S. Navy's diversity.
The Navy is made up of every single element of our population. It's probably the most diverse representation of the country. We have about 340,000 active duty sailors, and they come from every part of the country, every skin color, every ethnicity.
Miller didn't live to see the biggest effects of his heroics. He went back to sea in the Pacific, and in 1943, his ship was torpedoed and sank. 644 men died. Miller's body was never found. His name, though, still graces schools, roads, and community centers around the country. And the Navy that at first wouldn't even share that name will soon give it equal footing with the names of presidents. For NPR News, I'm Jay Price in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Now listen again.
Congress has voted to strip the names of Confederate generals from several Army bases. The president has vowed that won't happen. The issue might not even be resolved before Election Day. Meanwhile, the Navy is charting a whole new course. Jay Price of member station WUNC reports.
Henry Kissinger called supercarriers 100,000 tons of diplomacy. That power is reflected in the Navy's conventions for naming them, the USS John F. Kennedy, the Reagan, the Lincoln. But one supercarrier now on the drawing boards breaks sharply with tradition, the USS Doris Miller.
That is the first time that that ship of that class would be named after one, an enlisted person and an African-American.
Regina Akers is a historian with the Naval History and Heritage Command. Doris Dory Miller was one of the first American heroes of World War II. During the attack on Pearl Harbor, as his ship was sinking and captain dying, Miller jumped behind a machine gun and shot at Japanese planes until his ammunition was gone. Then he began rescuing sailors from the fiery waters of the harbor. As a black sailor in 1941, he wasn't even supposed to fire a gun.
One of the ways in which the Navy discriminated against African Americans was that they limited them to certain types of jobs. So for African Americans, not all, but many were messmen or stewards. Dory Miller was a messman, which meant that he basically took care of an officer, laid out his clothes, shined his shoes, and served meals.
An official Navy commendation list of those whose actions during the attack stood out mentioned a black sailor, but it didn't bother to name Miller, a 22-year-old sharecropper's son from Waco, Texas. The black press, though, discovered and published Miller's name.
And so the African-American community just swells up with pride, but at the same time, they're mad at the Navy for not having formally shared what Dory Miller did.
Black leaders at the time were already pressuring President Franklin D. Roosevelt for more opportunities for African Americans in the booming war industry and in the military. Roosevelt barely averted a march on Washington at one point. Admiral Chester Nimitz, the commander of the Pacific Fleet, wanted to take the bold step of awarding Miller the Navy Cross, then the third highest honor for heroism. Again, Regina Akers.
So in Nimitz's mind, the award would be good for the Navy and contradict the institutional racism that the Navy was known for.
Roosevelt, eager to keep the nation united behind the war effort, agreed. Miller's heroism was all but ignored by white America, but in the black community,
Miller, I mean, and just like the flip of a switch, becomes a celebrity. He becomes one of the first heroes, period, of the war, but certainly one of the first African-American heroes of the war. He was on recruitment posters. His image was everywhere.
And in Miller, suddenly the black newspapers had a weapon they'd been looking for.
He was a catalyst that gave them a lot of strength very early in the war. And they were determined to promote him publicly.
Baylor University history professor Michael Parrish is co-author of Doris Miller, Pearl Harbor, and the Birth of the Civil Rights Movement. He says that in war after war, African Americans had fought for their country, hoping their service would be rewarded with more rights, then had their hopes dashed, until Miller stepped behind that gun.
Things came together at Pearl Harbor for Doris Miller and for the Civil Rights Movement, probably to maximum effect. So World War II was really the turning point in that long struggle.
Even before he got the medal, the Navy began training black sailors for jobs like gunner's mate, radio man, radar operator. Later, it began commissioning black officers. Finally, in 1948, President Harry S. Truman ordered the military desegregated. All of that, Parrish says, can be traced to Dory Miller. The decision to name the new supercarrier for Miller was made by Thomas Modley, who was acting Secretary of the Navy until April.
I think it was probably long overdue.
Modley says it simply seemed like the right thing to do, given the U.S. Navy's diversity.
The Navy is made up of every single element of our population. It's probably the most diverse representation of the country. We have about 340,000 active duty sailors, and they come from every part of the country, every skin color, every ethnicity.
Miller didn't live to see the biggest effects of his heroics. He went back to sea in the Pacific, and in 1943, his ship was torpedoed and sank. 644 men died. Miller's body was never found. His name, though, still graces schools, roads, and community centers around the country, and the Navy that at first wouldn't even share that name will soon give it equal footing with the names of presidents. For NPR News, I'm Jay Price in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Task 2.
Listen to the interview new groups aim to get more Latinx stories to young readers. For items 1 to 10, fill in the gaps with 1 to 3 words, as they are said in the recording. Write your final answers in the grid provided below, as shown in example 0. You will hear the recording twice.
Now you have 2.5 minutes to read the task.
A small fraction of children's books that are published are written by or about Latinos. But several new groups of writers, editors, and literary agents are trying to change that. NPR's Mandalit Del Barco reports.
Latinx-themed children's books that are published are mostly immigration stories or historical biographies. But here's one silly, pun-filled tale about a family of Latino zombies.
Mo was a zombie with a deep, dark craving. It was dreadful, devious, absolutely despicable. Mo loved to eat vegetables.
That's actor Jaime Camille reading from Zombies Don't Eat Veggies, also published in Spanish as Los Zombies No Comen Verduras. Jorge Lacerda illustrated and co-wrote the book with his wife, Megan.
We're goofy and silly, and we like wanted to write a book out there that represented that.
The Columbia-born, Miami-raised 38-year-old Lacerda says publishers rejected the book at first.
Some people asking us to take out the Spanish. Some people wondering out loud why they had to be a Latinx family. And I think at that moment it became clear some people get it and some people don't.
The Lacerdas did find an agent and editor who got it. They got a two-book deal and are now shopping around a film treatment to animate their zombie story. Jorge Lacerda is also part of a team of authors helping others to break into the publishing industry. Just 5% of children's books are by or about Latinx people, according to the Cooperative Children's Book Center. 2 weeks ago, the group Latinx Pitch hosted their first event for writers and illustrators to pitch their children's book ideas.
All these wonderful stories were pitched on Twitter, and they were then followed up on by editors and agents who were excited to see them because there was a sense in the publishing industry that they were having a hard time finding authors from these communities. You can't have that excuse anymore, right? Here we are.
Another group called Las Musas, the Muses, supports Latina writers with mentorships and webinars. They're planning their first online book festival in December. Writer and activist Aida Salazar is one of the founders of Las Musas.
We decided to create this collective that would help amplify each other's work. And we didn't want to be pitted against each other. And that happens in many publishing houses. They'll say, well, we've got that one Latina author, so therefore we don't need another. We know that we have to build each other up. We know that there's plenty of room at the table and that in some instances we're ready to create our very own table if they don't want to invite us.
Salazar's second book, Land of the Cranes, debuted 2 weeks ago. It's a fictional account, told in verse, of a 9-year-old girl who writes poetry while being held in an immigration detention center. Salazar says she wrote the book to protest immigrant roundups, and she drew on her own family's experiences crossing the border, enduring ICE detention, and getting deported.
I was born in Mexico, and I was brought over when I was 9 months old, and I lived until I was 12 years old as an undocumented immigrant, along with my family. And so this kind of terror that was instilled in the community was very reminiscent of the same kind of cautiousness and fear of La Migra that we had growing up.
Contrast Salazar's book with American Dirt, the best-selling novel about a Mexican family fleeing narco violence in Mexico. Writer Miriam Gurba and others called out non-Mexican author Janine Cummins for writing what they consider offensive stereotypical portrayals. Backlash against American Dirt prompted writer Roberto Lovato to create the hashtag Dignidad Literaria, literary dignity. Now, Dignidad Literaria is a movement for Latinx literature.
This is a clear victory for nuestra gente. Your voices were heard.
In February, children's book author David Bowles celebrated after he and other leaders of Dignidad Literaria met with American Dirt publishers Flatiron and Macmillan. They demanded the company sign more Latinx writers and diversify their editorial staffs.
We spent 2 hours having some really, really difficult conversations. And by the end of it, they conceded that, yes, they did have a problem and that they were going to fix it.
Bowles, who lives on the Texas-Mexico border, says Macmillan now has a diversity and inclusion council. Dignidad Literaria is working with the Congressional Hispanic Caucus to hold the big publishers accountable, starting with pressuring them to reveal employee demographics. This month, for the first time, Penguin Random House did. 7% of their non-warehouse workers are Latino, compared to 18.5% in the country. Mandalit del Barco, NPR News.
Now listen again.
A small fraction of children's books that are published are written by or about Latinos. But several new groups of writers, editors, and literary agents are trying to change that. NPR's Mandalit del Barco reports.
Latinx-themed children's books that are published are mostly immigration stories or historical biographies. But here's one silly, pun-filled tale about a family of Latino zombies.
Mo was a zombie with a deep, dark craving. It was dreadful, devious, absolutely despicable. Mo loved to eat vegetables.
That's actor Jaime Camil reading from Zombies Don't Eat Veggies, also published in Spanish as Los Zombies No Comen Verduras. Jorge Lacerda illustrated and co-wrote the book with his wife Megan.
We're goofy and silly, and we like wanted to write a book out there that represented that.
The Columbia-born, Miami-raised 38-year-old Lacerda says publishers rejected the book at first.
Some people asking us to take out the Spanish, some people wondering out loud why they had to be a Latinx family, and I think at that moment it became clear some people get it and some people don't.
The Lacerdas did find an agent and editor who got it. They got a two-book deal and are now shopping around a film treatment to animate their zombie story. Jorge Lacerda is also part of a team of authors helping others to break into the publishing industry. Just 5% of children's books are by or about Latinx people, according to the Cooperative Children's Book Center. 2 weeks ago, the group Latinx Pitch hosted their first event for writers and illustrators to pitch their children's book ideas.
All these wonderful stories were pitched on Twitter, and they were then followed up on by editors and agents who were excited to see them because there was a sense in the publishing industry that they were having a hard time finding authors from these communities. You can't have that excuse anymore, right? Here we are.
Another group called Las Musas, the Muses, supports Latina writers with mentorships and webinars. They're planning their first online book festival in December. Writer and activist Aida Salazar is one of the founders of Las Musas.
We decided to create this collective that would help amplify each other's work. And we didn't want to be pitted against each other. And that happens in many publishing houses. They'll say, well, we've got that one Latina author, so therefore we don't need another. We know that we have to build each other up. We know that there's plenty of room at the table and that in some instances we're ready to create our very own table if they don't want to invite us.
Salazar's second book, Land of the Cranes, debuted 2 weeks ago. It's a fictional account, told in verse, of a 9-year-old girl who writes poetry while being held in an immigration detention center. Salazar says she wrote the book to protest immigrant roundups, and she drew on her own family's experiences crossing the border, enduring ICE detention, and getting deported.
I was born in Mexico, and I was brought over when I was 9 months old, and I lived until I was 12 years old as an undocumented immigrant, along with my family. And so this kind of terror that was instilled in the community was very reminiscent of the same kind of cautiousness and fear of La Migra that we had growing up.
Contrast Salazar's book with American Dirt, the best-selling novel about a Mexican family fleeing narco violence in Mexico. Writer Miriam Gurba and others called out non-Mexican author Janine Cummins for writing what they consider offensive stereotypical portrayals. Backlash against American Dirt prompted writer Roberto Lovato to create the hashtag Dignidad Literaria, literary dignity. Now Dignidad Literaria is a movement for Latinx literature.
This is a clear victory for nuestra gente. Your voices were heard.
In February, children's book author David Bowles celebrated after he and other leaders of Dignidad Literaria met with American Dirt publishers Flatiron and Macmillan. They demanded the company sign more Latinx writers and diversify their editorial staffs.
We spent 2 hours having some really, really difficult conversations. And by the end of it, they conceded that, yes, they did have a problem and that they were going to fix it.
Bowles, who lives on the Texas-Mexico border, says Macmillan now has a diversity and inclusion council. Dignidad Literaria is working with the Congressional Hispanic Caucus to hold the big publishers accountable, starting with pressuring them to reveal employee demographics. This month, for the first time, Penguin Random House did. 7% of their non-warehouse workers are Latino, compared to 18.5% in the country. Mandalit del Barco, NPR News.
Task 3.
Listen to an interview with radio and TV presenter Sir Terry Wogan. For items 1 to 10, decide if the statement is true or false according to what is said in the recording. Write your final answers in the grid provided below, as shown in example 0. You will hear the recording twice.
Now you have 2.5 minutes to read the task.
So Terry Wogan, great to see you.
Thank you, Matt.
Before we start, can I have the Sir Terry Wogan seal of approval on the clock?
Of course. It brings back memories of a free gift we used to give on Wake Up to Wogan called the Woot-Whack, the Wake Up to Wogan alarm clock.
This would certainly get you up in the morning, wouldn't it?
It certainly would. And I could do with something like that, because quite often the old alarm clock doesn't oblige. And I find myself dashing out of the house at the last minute. Desperate.
Right, we've got to start. There's only one rule. Mm. There's absolutely no swearing.
Oh. Okay, well, I'll go now. Then.
Right, here we go. You can count us down, Sir Terry.
Good. Here we go. 2, 1, 0.
Sir Terry, you have been married for 44 years and very much still in love.
Who told you that? Because that's a foul and contemptible lie. No, it's absolutely true. My wife, in her time, was known as the luckiest woman in Ireland and is now, and has been for many years, one of the luckiest women in Britain and Europe.
Would she say the same thing?
No, she wouldn't. But she'd probably take the other view.
Now, do people tend to address you as sir?
No, I don't try and encourage that. People do. And, I mean, why not? The Queen was good enough to make me a sir, so I'm happy to be called one. But I tend to cleave toward the Michael Caine edict, which is that he doesn't expect anybody to call him sir, but when anybody sends him a letter addressed to Mr. Michael Caine, he throws it in the wastepaper basket.
Now, you laugh a lot on your show, on your radio show.
Yeah, that's the whole point. That's the only reason I get up in the morning. It isn't for the money. And it isn't because it's as black as your grandfather's outside in the winter, particularly. But it's because of the fun. I mean, I do come to work with a song in my heart.
Have you ever completely lost it on the show?
Only when, on one occasion, well, not completely. I lose it nearly every morning for long periods. But I only really lost it for a really long time, probably about half an hour, when my former producer, the great and lovely Paul Walters, who's a very dear friend, when he broke wind. On air. I mean, I've never heard anything quite like it in my life. And all was silence for a while and just sort of suppressed laughter and hysterical shouts from all over the place. And in fact, it became a little a moment of great radio moment because Chris Evans had heard it and recorded it and continued to play it for many years.
Which have you preferred, television or radio?
There's no, they're completely different things. I love doing television when I'm doing television. I love doing radio when I'm doing radio. Radio, in a sense, gives more satisfaction because you can do more with it. You know, television just takes away the ability to think or takes away the imagination. It provides the pictures for you. So you don't have to think, you don't have to listen. Whereas radio, you have to concentrate a little bit on what's being said, though I doubt very many people concentrate on what I'm saying.
What do you think is the secret to getting the best out of an interviewee?
I think the secret of getting the best out of an interviewee is to probably ask the right kind of questions.
Am I right asking the right kind of questions?
No, you failed abjectly.
What are your hobbies?
I sit around a lot. I'm very sedentary and extremely lazy, and people seem to think that I work very hard when I don't. I haven't had a proper job since I left the bank when I was about 12, just after the Peloponnesian War. And so I'm not qualified to talk about working for a living because I don't ever feel as if I had. But that's because I'm lucky enough to be doing something I really love.
As you say, you started off life as a banker. Mm. Bankers have come in for a bit of stick recently. Do you feel any sympathy for them?
Not at all. There was a list made in one of the papers of the various people who have made a mess of things in the bank. And it just said, what's the difference between all these people and Terry Wogan? You see, Terry Wogan's the only one with a banking qualification. I'm not saying I could have done any better, but I certainly wouldn't loan money, 100% of money to people who haven't got any money themselves. That was the preposterous part of it.
Can we talk Eurovision?
No. Go on.
Where did you watch it this year?
I watched it in the bedroom of my family for the very first time in 35 years, or however long I've been doing it. I watched it for the first time with Helen, my wife. And it was extraordinary. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. I mean, I don't think, it's a bit like the Beijing Olympics. I think the Moscow Eurovision can never be excelled in terms of spectacle and sheer brilliance of production. It was magnificent.
Any regrets giving it up?
No. Well, I suppose, yeah, it was lovely to do and I had great fun doing it. I think Graham did a great job. And I don't mean that sycophantically. I thought he did a great job. And good luck to dear Lloyd Webber, because, you know, he stuck his neck out and came fifth, and that's fine. I'm pleased to say I delivered myself of a speech to the EBU in Lucerne on the week before the
EBU. Being
European Broadcasting Union.
Just so everyone knows.
Exactly. And they, we're nearly,
it's chiming.
Nearly out of time. So I said what I thought was wrong. They didn't change it because of me, but at least they changed the voting, and it's made the whole thing, it's thrown it open wide.
Can we talk about golf before we finish?
Yes.
You're a bit of a star, aren't you?
I am indeed. I sank the longest putt ever seen on television. I think subsequently somebody called Tiger Woods has beaten me.
British and Irish Lions, can they win?
Yes.
It's all over, Terry. Sir Terry, it's all over.
Thank
Great
you, Matt.
To see you. Great to see you.
Great pleasure.
Now listen again.
Sir Terry Wogan, great to see you.
Thank you, Matt.
Before we start, can I have the Sir Terry Wogan seal of approval on the clock?
Of course. It brings back memories of a free gift we used to give on Wake Up to Wogan called the Woot-Whack, the Wake Up to Wogan alarm clock.
This would certainly get you up in the morning, wouldn't it?
It certainly would. And I could do with something like that, because quite often the old alarm clock doesn't oblige. And I find myself dashing out of the house at the last minute. Desperate.
Right, we've got to start. There's only one rule. There's absolutely no swearing.
Oh. Okay, well, I'll go now then.
Right, here we go. You can count us down, Sir Terry.
Good. Here we go. 2, 1, 0.
Sir Terry, you have been married for 44 years and very much still in love.
Who told you that? Because that's a foul and contemptible lie. No, it's absolutely true. My wife, in her time, was known as the luckiest woman in Ireland and is now, and has been for many years, one of the luckiest women in Britain and Europe.
Would she say the same thing?
No, she wouldn't. She'd probably take the other view.
Now, do people tend to address you as sir?
No, I don't try and encourage that. People do. And, I mean, why not? The Queen was good enough to make me a sir, so I'm happy to be called one. But I tend to cleave toward the Michael Caine edict, which is that he doesn't expect anybody to call him sir, but when anybody sends him a letter addressed to Mr. Michael Caine, he throws it in the wastepaper basket.
Now, you laugh a lot on your show, on your radio show.
Yeah, that's the whole point. That's the only reason I get up in the morning. It isn't for the money, and it isn't because it's as black as your grandfather's outside in the winter particularly, but it's because of the fun. I mean, I do come to work with a song in my heart.
Have you ever completely lost it on the show?
Only when, on one occasion, well, not completely, I lose it nearly every morning for long periods, but I only really lost it for a really long time, probably about half an hour, when my former producer, the great and lovely Paul Walters, who was a very dear friend, when he broke wind on air. I mean, I've never heard anything quite like it in my life. And all was silence for a while and just sort of suppressed laughter and hysterical shouts from all over the place. And in fact, it became a little a moment of great radio moment, because Chris Evans had heard it and recorded it and continued to play it for many years.
Which have you preferred, television or radio?
there's no, they're completely different things. I love doing television when I'm doing television. I love doing radio when I'm doing radio. Radio, in a sense, gives more satisfaction because you can do more with it. You know, television just takes away the ability to think, or takes away the imagination. It provides the pictures for you, so you don't have to think, you don't have to listen. Whereas radio, you have to concentrate a little bit on what's being said, though I don't. Very many people concentrate on what I'm saying.
What do you think is the secret to getting the best out of an interviewee?
I think the secret of getting the best out of an interviewee is to probably ask the right kind of questions.
Am I right asking the right kind of questions?
No, you failed abjectly.
What are your hobbies?
I sit around a lot. I'm very sedentary and extremely lazy, and people seem to think that I work very hard when I don't. I haven't had a proper job since I left the bank when I was about 12, just after the Peloponnesian War. And so I'm not qualified to talk about working for a living because I don't ever feel as if I had. But that's because I'm lucky enough to be doing something I really love.
As you say, you started off life as a banker. Mm. Bankers have come in for a bit of stick recently. Do you feel any sympathy for them?
Not at all. There was a list made in one of the papers of the various people who have made a mess of things in the bank. And it just said, what's the difference between all these people and Terry Wogan? You see, Terry Wogan's the only one with a banking qualification. I'm not saying I could have done any better, but I certainly wouldn't loan money, 100% of money to people who haven't got any money themselves. That was the preposterous part of it.
Can we talk Eurovision?
No. Go on.
Where did you watch it this year?
I watched it in the bedroom of my family for the very first time in 35 years, or however long I've been doing it. I watched it for the first time with Helen, my wife. And it was extraordinary. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. I mean, I don't think, it's a bit like the Beijing Olympics. I think the Moscow Eurovision can never be excelled in terms of spectacle and sheer brilliance of production. It was magnificent.
Any regrets giving it up?
No. I suppose, yeah, it was lovely to do and I had great fun doing it. I think Graham did a great job. And I don't mean that sycophantically. I thought he did a great job. And good luck to dear Lloyd Webber because, you know, he stuck his neck out and came fifth, and that's fine. I'm pleased to say I delivered myself of a speech to the EBU in Lucerne on the week before the
EBU being?
The European Broadcasting Union.
Just so everyone knows.
Exactly. And they... we're nearly
it's chiming.
Nearly
it's
out of time.
Done.
So I said what I thought was wrong. They didn't change it because of me, but at least they changed the voting, and it's made the whole thing, it's thrown it open wide.
Can we talk about golf before we finish?
Yes.
You're a bit of a star, aren't you?
I am indeed. I sank the longest putt ever seen on television. I think subsequently somebody called Tiger Woods has beaten me.
British and Irish Lions, can they win?
Yes.
It's all over, Terry. Sir Terry, it's all over.
Thank
you,
Matt.
Great to see you. Great to see you.
Great pleasure.
Fin de la prueba.